So the first case for oral argument this morning is the State of South Dakota Appellant versus Trent Danielson, Appellee. For the appellant state is Mr. John Fitzgerald, the State's Attorney from Lawrence County, from Deadwood. And I understand Megan Fitzgerald Poppin also, but Mr. Fitzgerald will be presenting this morning. Okay. And Mr. John Frederickson, attorney from Deadwood for the Appellee, Mr. Trent Danielson. Mr. Fitzgerald, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
May it please the court and counsel. My name is John Fitzgerald. I'm the Lawrence County State's Attorney, and I represent the State of South Dakota in this appeal. The issue before the court is whether or not collateral estoppel bars the prosecution of the defendant, Trent Danielson, for perjury after he was acquitted for grand theft. The facts of the case are intertwined with collateral estoppel, so it is necessary, I believe, to go into the facts of this case. The defendant was employed at Rocket Loop Company in Spearfish as a mechanic. In September of 2006, the defendant was fired after Rocket Loop discovered that the defendant had been receiving and taking checks from one of their customers, a Dr. Cox of Spearfish, who happened to collect historic Studebaker cars. That's four of them. After the defendant was fired, the Rocket Loop Company found out that he'd actually received seven different checks from Rocket Loop that totaled about $1,800. He was suspected and charged then with taking other property from Rocket Loop, and I'm not going to go into too much of the facts of that because that's not pertinent to the analysis of Judge Macy's decision to dismiss the charge on collateral estoppel constitutional grounds. But back to the facts. The police were called by Rocket Loop, and they accused the defendant of stealing the money that those checks represented because they said that that money was theirs, that he, Dr. Cox, was their customer, and that the mechanic work was done on their property, and that Mr. Danielson was, in fact, their mechanic, and he was employed there. Cox, when he was interviewed by the police, said that the defendant had told him as to the clutch that a spring had gone out. He'd heard a spring go out in his 53 Studebaker Commander, and that he had changed the clutch. When the defendant was interviewed by the police as far as the clutch, he said that he had changed the clutch. Didn't specify anything more than the clutch. At the trial that was conducted, the defendant and his ex-wife both testified that the defendant and Dr. Cox had entered into a side agreement to do the mechanic work for Cox. At the trial, the defendant testified that he'd done the work for Dr. Cox at his father's garage, after hours on his own time. It was not part of his employment. He said that Dr. Cox was mistaken, that he had never told him that he changed the clutch. He said what he meant was the clutch pack, and that were the gears he described, inside of a different vehicle, inside the automatic transmission of a 1950 Studebaker pickup. So what he said, in essence, was he hadn't done a clutch job, he had done a transmission change, transmission job. At the trial, the defendant produced a picture. It was defendant's exhibit B5. And the defendant told the jury that that was a picture of the gears that he removed from the inside of the 1950 maroon Studebaker transmission. The pictures, the exhibits were brought into the court to bolster his testimony, his credibility, his story, to lend some verification that he had actually changed the gears inside the automatic transmission. The picture showed gears for a 350 size transmission, but this was a 400 size transmission in the 1950 Studebaker. So he told the jury that the gears were interchangeable. This 1950 Studebaker has historic license plates, can only be used in parades and going to gas stations. Dr. Cox hasn't driven it 50 miles since the defendant said he had done the work to the internal gears of its transmission. The defendant was found not guilty by the jury in the grand theft trial. So after the trial was over, the 1950 Studebaker transmission was dismantled by Gerald Frame, a 40-year expert in automatic transmissions in Whitewood, South Dakota. And after Mr. Frame dismantled the transmission, he said that the transmission in the 1950 Studebaker had not been taken apart in decades.
Let me just interrupt you and ask you a question on the on these other two witnesses that testified, the experts or whatever, about whether or not the work had been done. How did their testimony come into evidence? Did you present as the, did the state present their testimony partly in your case in chief, this Jancevic and Parcells?
I would say that Rich Parcells was definitely a mechanic expert. Jake Jancevic knows a lot about mechanics, and he manages the Rocket Lube company. It's a quick change.
Did you present them in your case in chief?
Yes, I did.
And what did they testify to in the case in chief?
They testified in the case in chief that the clutch in the 1953 Studebaker had not been overhauled or worked on. And Rich Parcells, through discovery, just before the trial started, defense counsel gave me pictures of the gears. They weren't identified as such, but I showed them to Mr. Parcells, and he said that those were 350 size transmission gears from the inside of an automatic transmission. So that got us to thinking that the story would now evolve potentially at trial too.
Okay, so I guess my where I'm going on that is that actually, whether or not he'd done the work on either the clutch or the transmission was introduced in your case in chief.
It was definitely mentioned, Your Honor, yes.
So are we to have to sit here as the triers of fact and try to figure out whether the parts come out of a 53 transmission or a 50 transmission?
No, I think the issue is different than that.
Well, your mechanics say the 50 transmission was not touched, and the defendant here testified on its basis. I understand the perjury charge that he did fix it. Is that right?
The perjury charge is that he took an oath and said that he had dismantled the transmission in a vehicle, and he had not done
so that. So, back to my original question, are we supposed to be triers of fact to figure out which transmission he worked on?
No, because the... No, Your Honor, the transmission work was not an essential ingredient of the reasons for which the jury found the defendant not guilty of grand theft. This is a separate independent action, and it goes to the whole integrity of the system when people take an oath and don't keep it. Mr. Frank said that the gears inside the transmission that the defendant swore under oath he dismantled were very worn. They had 50 to 100,000 miles on them. And he said that these appear to be the original parts to this vehicle. He said that a 350 and a 400 transmission were not interchangeable as far as the gears inside of them. That the picture, therefore, was false. The testimony given by the defendant was false. So the defendant was indicted for perjury for his testimony. And Judge Macy dismissed the indictment. And he said that under Ash versus Swenson, the first trial, the grand theft trial, had been just a dry run for the perjury trial, which is impossible, as the state could not have known, number one, that the defendant would testify, let alone know what he was going to say when he decided to take the stand. The court, Judge Macy, ruled that under collateral estoppel principles, under the Fifth Amendment, the state was prohibited from bringing a perjury prosecution. Adopted basically a winner-take-all approach. And Ash versus Swenson is the 1970 case from the U.S. Supreme Court that deals with making collateral estoppel applicable under the Fifth Amendment and the 14th Amendment to the states in this country. And in that case, factually, Ash had been involved, had been accused of a robbery in 1960 of six people that attended a poker game in Missouri. There were three or four masked men that had come in with shotguns and pistols. There had been a robbery, and he was tried for robbing Mr. Knight. He was found not guilty. 6 weeks later, the state of Missouri put him on trial for robbing Mr. Roberts, a second of victim at the robbery scene, and this time he was convicted. And the state of Missouri conceded in that appeal that the first trial was a dry run for the second trial. And this concept of collateral estoppel that the federal court had interpreted for 50 years as far as federal prosecutions was now for the first time in 1970 made a part of the state constitution by way of the 14th Amendment. And it basically, the rule says that once a issue of ultimate fact has been determined by a jury, then that issue cannot be subject to further lawsuit. They went on to say that in that case, you need to examine the entire record and ask the question, could a jury have grounded its verdict upon an issue other than the issue that the defendant seeks to foreclose consideration of? So in this case, if you apply that rule to the Danielson case, the answer is the verdict could be grounded upon something other than the issue of whether the transmission work was done, because it was not an element, and the defense was simply that there was a side agreement between Cox and the defendant for him to do the work sort of moonlighting on his own time in another place.
So let me ask you this. You know, the test is whether the underlying fact that the jury decided in the first case was necessarily determined by that jury. That's the way the test has evolved under Ash. Didn't you make the truthfulness of his claim regarding repair of the transmission a fact that was necessarily determined when you told that jury, my case depends on whether you believe this guy or not? Didn't that, by making that argument to the jury, didn't you essentially make that jury make that finding of fact in that case, in the first case?
No, Justice Zinter, I did not. The issues for the jury to determine were those issues that the judge fashioned in his instructions to the jury.
I understand the instructions, and I understand what grand theft, the elements of grand theft, but didn't you argue it was central to your case? As I understand it, you argued our case comes down to whether you believe this guy or not.
I certainly said that his credibility was important for the jury. And I don't retreat from having made that statement. However, my argument doesn't change the Constitution. State's attorney in closing remark doesn't change the issues that are for the jury to determine. Those are the issues that were identified by the judge and his instructions to the jury, and those are the essential ingredients of what grand theft is. I was merely restating what I thought was appropriate argument under the facts of a trial that had gone on for several days.
Who was the victim of the grand theft?
The victim of the grand theft was Rocket.
So how does it affect or be material to that charge whether or not the work was done on Dr. Cox's 1950 Studebaker?
Because, you can't go into a courtroom and take an oath and produce photographs for a jury and say, this is work that I did, when that is false and misleading testimony, and then make the claim that even though you're trying to verify or bolster or lend credence to your testimony, that that's not a material matter. That would be a matter for the trial judge to determine whether or not the matter of the change in the transmission was material.
But the elements of the crime were the same whether he said he worked on the transmission or not. The elements were a charge against Rocket Lube.
The elements that this jury was asked to determine were simply this. Did the defendant take property of Rocket Lube with the intent to deprive Rocket Lube of its property, and was the value over $1,000? So if they believe that the defendant and Dr. Cox had entered into a side agreement, and even if he had ripped Dr. Cox off, so to speak, by not doing the work, there was nothing that the jury could do. The jury couldn't insert or cross out in the judge's instructions the name of Rocket Lube and insert Dr. Cox and then found him guilty of stealing from Dr. Cox. He was never have alleged to have stolen anything from Dr. Cox. It was Rocket Lube's property. He got those checks as part of his employment. It was within the scope of his employment. He was supposed to give that money over to his company, and he converted it. So they did not have to reach the issue of whether or not he had told the truth about the work on the transmission when they found him not guilty of grand theft, because Dr. Cox never was the victim. It was always Rocket Lube.
You know, that's true, except you made it a real important part of your case. So aren't we limited, or isn't the court limited in looking at how you tried your case, not an after the fact, but how did you try your case? And you presented that issue and experts to refute that issue in your case in chief and in rebuttal. So it was smack dab in front of the jury. How do you write that out of your prior case and say, well, now we're going to try it again?
Justice Myra Henry, I'm not asking that be written out of the case. Those are the facts. Those are the arguments that were made. But this defendant took an oath, said he had taken the gears out of a 1950 Studebaker, and obviously when he said that, his credibility became an issue. Like in all trials, anybody who testifies, their credibility becomes an issue. I didn't have, in the middle of the trial, the transmission dismantled, when for the first time he now claimed that he had done a transmission work rather than the clutch that he told the police about and that he had told Dr. Cox about. But I certainly wasn't going to leave that aspect of the case alone, and I did what I could to try to rebut that claim. Rich Parcells looked underneath the transmission of the 1950 Studebaker. He said that there were no marks on the bolts that would be consistent with someone having altered it. Then the defendant testified, well, you looked in the wrong place, because what I did was, when I had it in my dad's garage, I took the motor out rather than come into the transmission from underneath. I took the motor out and then went in from the top side of this vehicle rather than take the transmission out from underneath. So that was the essence of the testimony. Credibility is always an issue. I don't submit that the state of South Dakota, through closing statements or the way in which it has the strategy of a trial to rebut statements made by a defendant, somehow changed the Constitution or this doctrine of collateral estoppel.
2 minutes, Counselor.
Let me ask you a little bit of an academic question about the fact that you're asking to charge perjury the second time. You know, perjury requires false testimony regarding a material fact. By definition, are you running into an obstacle? Because if it has to be a material fact, that kind of suggests that it was something that was necessary and important in the first trial in order for it to be material.
Well, my answer to that would be that there's always going to be some questions in a perjury prosecution, because if it were about some completely side issue, then it wouldn't be pertinent. It wouldn't be material if he was talking about the weather on a particular day. So there's always going to be some crossover. But he, the defendant, was the one who had come into the courtroom and brought this testimony. He affirmatively brought this defense into the courtroom. This wasn't something that I brought into my case in chief.
Well, then back to Justice Meyer Henry's question. I thought you said earlier that you did bring this in your case in chief.
I responded to it when it was brought up by the defendant. In the middle of the trial, I asked Mr. Parcells to go and look at the 1950 Studebaker to see what he could tell. Talking about Judge Macy's decision, I have a few things that I'd like to bring to the court's attention. At page 4, Judge Macy said that both the grand theft and the perjury charge required the state to prove the defendant was untruthful when he stated that he did the work on the 1950 Studebaker. I would submit that, no, that's not true. In the grand theft trial, the defendant's untruthfulness was not an element. Only in perjury is false statement an element. The untruthfulness of a defendant at a trial is never an element of a crime because the Fifth Amendment guarantees the defendant never has to testify, and you never know if they will.
Time has expired, but thank you, counsel. Mr. Frederson, you have 20 minutes, sir.
Please the court, counsel. My name is John Frederickson. I have represented Mr. Danielson from the beginning of these proceedings. I think the analysis of this case takes place under the Ash v. Swenson. I believe the state agrees with that. The Ash v. Swenson case was decided a number of years ago, and it has been interpreted by a lot of cases since then, even those cases dealing with perjury and subsequent trial on perjury. The most recent case was decided in June of 2009 in the case of Yeager versus the United States at 129 Supreme Court 2360.
Is that cited in your brief?
No, it isn't, Your Honor. I just found that last week when I was looking at it. So.
Okay. Your luck requires you under our court rules to submit 10 copies of that to the clerk following and a copy to counsel.
The Yeager v. U.S. case is a case involving the Enron debacle and one of the people that worked for Enron had made some statements with regard to the value and the complexity and the network that Enron was setting up. The government, after Enron, of course, collapsed, then the government later went and filed charges against Mr. Yeager and indicted him for security, wires fraud, conspiracy, and money laundering. The significance of the Yeager case, I think as it relates to this case, is that it expanded the double jeopardy collateral estoppel doctrine to include cases that were not necessarily decided where there was an acquittal. It went to cases where there was a hung jury. But in that case, the court reiterated those cases and made the distinction with regard to cases that involved acquittal, and it said that a jury's verdict of acquittal represents the community's collective judgment regarding all the evidence and the arguments presented to it, even if the verdict is based upon egregious and erroneous foundation. Its finality is unassailable. I think that's important in this case because as we go through the Ash v. Swenson analysis, as Judge Macy did, the ultimate result here was that the jury reached a verdict of acquittal on all of the charges for which Mr. Danielson was charged. If we turn now to the analysis that Judge Macy did on this case and the facts, the Ash v. Swenson case requires the court to do three things. It has a three-pronged test. First, it must examine the issues and see that they are substantially similar and material. Secondly, it must determine whether or not those issues were actually litigated at the prior proceedings. And the third prong of the test is that they must see if the jury could have reached its verdict on an issue other than that which was litigated. So if you look at the case of Danielson, State versus Danielson. I think the facts become very important. As Mr. Fitzgerald indicated, Mr. Danielson was terminated from Rocket Lube, and Rocket Lube did have the Spearfish Police Department investigate the case. In its investigation, the police department interviewed Mr. Danielson, Mr. Cox, and the people at Rocket Lube, Jake Jankovich and others. That investigation took place before the indictment came down. When the indictment came down, it had 22 different elements in it, 22 different charges. At the time of trial, after we had an amended bill submitted by the state to clarify what issues or what items they actually were claiming were stolen, the state called its witnesses, put its trial on, but it noticeably did not call Mr. Darren Fednow, who was the police officer who investigated the charges. They never called him as a witness. They listed him but didn't. Secondly, as the court has indicated, during the trial, the state called Mr. Jankovich, and he testified that he got up and he looked at the transmission. In his opinion, there was no evidence that there was any work done. Then he called his expert, Mr. Parcells. Mr. Parcells then testified that he crawled under and looked at the transmissions, and he didn't see, there was no evidence that it had been out in 40 years. Mr. Danielson then took the stand. Under cross-examination from Mr. Fitzgerald, they talked about the issues of the transmission, the work done on those transmissions. At the time, then after Mr. Danielson testified, then he brought up Mr. Parcells again, and they talked about the transmission and the work done on the transmission. Finally, in the closing, Mr. Fitzgerald brought up no less than three times that the truthfulness was an issue. Mr. Danielson's truthfulness was an issue. And he indicated, he said, he has an explanation for everything. If you believe them all, and you should acquit him, you should find him innocent.
Is there any distinction between direct testimony you would elicit from your client or fact was brought up by the state and cross?
I don't believe so, because I think once the issue is there and it's subject to cross-examination, I believe that the issue is before the jury. And I believe they had to make a decision, they had to make a determination as to the truthfulness of the issue of whether or not he worked on the transmission or any of the cars of Mr. Cox.
In your trial strategy, in your closing, did you contest the state's statement to the jury that you either believe the defendant or you don't? I'm paraphrasing, of course.
I don't remember if I did. I do know that the state, as I said on three or four occasions, indicated that the truthfulness was an issue. In fact, he even made the point that the issue of the truthfulness and the trustworthiness of the witness was up to their determination. It was up to them to determine. So there's no question in my mind that and I don't believe in Judge Macy's mind, that Mr. Danielson's truthfulness as to the work that he'd done on the transmission for Mr. Cox in his cars was an issue that was considered in their case in chief in the prior proceedings, and it's the same issue that they're going to testify to in the perjury trial. Because if you bring it, if you look at what's going to happen in the perjury trial, is he's going to call in, he's indicated he's going to call Mr. Parcells again, he's going to talk about the same issue, the work on the transmission. He's now going to bring in a Mr. Kimball, who hasn't taken the transmission apart, but he's going to testify that it didn't look like it was taken apart. And then he's going to call in Mr. Frank Frame, and he's going to testify that it doesn't look like there was any work on the transmission. That issue has already been presented to the jury. It's already been decided.
Well, you know, I don't think there's any dispute about that. The first two elements of the ASH test seem to be satisfied here in your favor. But the question really is whether this issue was necessarily decided by the jury. That means if the jury could have decided the case on a different basis, then collateral estoppel does not apply. And what I'm having trouble with, help me with this. You know, Cox was not the victim in this case. Rocket Loop was. And so the question the jury had to decide was whether there was stealing going on from Rocket Loop. And whether he ripped off Cox, what difference would that make to whether he was doing side work or not? Whether he was ripping off Cox? That didn't make any difference to him.
Justice Inter, I think that in order to make that determination on whether or not there was grand theft, they had to look at the issue of was that work done and did he receive payment. Regardless of where the payment went, they had to decide was that work actually done.
Well, let's assume that he didn't do the work and that he lied and that he got a check. Let's just say it's $500. But it was work that should have been done for Rocket Loop because it was on Rocket Loop's time. And so the jury, what difference would it make to the jury whether he did or did not, whether he did or did not do it? If the check should have gone to Rocket Loop, then it would have been grand theft, whether he actually did the work or not.
Well, and I believe that issue, that presentation was given to the jury, so they necessarily had to consider that and weigh that with the evidence and the testimony that had been received. So I think even if you take that stand, that issue was still before the jury. So that's been decided, too.
Well, it was before the jury, no question about it. The question is, was it necessary for the jury to have decided that issue to render its judgment?
I believe they had to decide the issue of whether or not the work was done by Mr. Danielson before they could say that there was payment due, whether it went to Rocket Loop or whether it went to Mr. Cox.
Do you have any cases that say that the scope of materiality can be expanded by comments like the state made in closing, where you either believe the defendant's story or you don't, and that determines his guilt or not guilt?
I believe there is a case, I do have it, that talks about when you look at the last element of the Ash test and you look at what the jury has to consider, or excuse me, what the court has to consider in its evaluation. They have to look at the evidence, they have to look at the charge, they have to look at the arguments and the testimony in order to determine whether there was another issue upon which the jury could have rested its verdict. I submit that the lower court, Judge Macy, did that in this case. He did the evaluation. I think it's important to note that as I stated earlier in the case of Yeager versus United States, the fact that there was an acquittal in this case makes it the finality is unassailable, meaning that it's final. So I believe that the jury did discuss that. I don't know that they talked about. I don't know about expanding materiality. I think. If the issue is consistent on both and it's important or it's material to both, I don't know how you would expand it. I'm not sure I answered your question. But.
Did you argue to the jury in the final analysis that there was a side agreement and that's why grand theft did not occur?
I know we talked about a side agreement. I don't know that I don't believe that I argued that to the jury, but I believe we did discuss it in the trial.
Well, what was the essence of your defense?
The essence of the defense for part of the work, well, with this particular issue, yes, we did argue that there was an agreement with Mr. Cox because of what happened in September, I believe it was in September of 2006, Mr. Cox was not just a customer of Rocket Loop. He was a shareholder in Rocket Loop, and as a result of that relationship with Rocket Loop, he was entitled, or it was his understanding, that he was entitled to get labor at a cost of $25 an hour, and that he was entitled to get parts at whatever the cost was. He became infuriated in September because he felt that he had been overbilled, and he complained to Rocket Loop, and in going through the bills, they found out that Rocket Loop had actually doubled and was charging $50 an hour, and he wasn't getting the parts for a cost. That's when he then approached Mr. Danielson and talked to see about getting a better deal, or, you know, have him do the work, because he was basically getting screwed by Rocket. So,
was Cox, he was a part owner or a minority?
He was a minority shareholder. He originally went in, he had a larger share. Mr. Hess had testified that he had a larger ownership interest early on. There apparently were some financial reasons that he wanted to be bought down, but he still was a 1% ownership, had a 1% ownership in Rocket. So, in closing, I guess the issue seems very straightforward, very narrow to me. I would ask that the court uphold Mr. Macy's, or Judge Macy's ruling, and I believe that collateral estoppel does bar another prosecution for perjury in this case.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Fitzgerald, you have 10 minutes, sir.
I haven't read Yeager versus the United States, but I do not believe that there'll ever be a case, nor is this a case, where the principles that need to be balanced in a situation like this have all gone out the window, or that they've all changed. This goes to the integrity of the entire system, perjury. Perjury has to be balanced with the finality and the sanctity of an acquittal. It means something, but perjury also means something too. In civil cases, under Rule 60B, if there's been a final decision made in a multi-million dollar lawsuit amongst parties, the whole judgment is subject to being set aside if there's been fraud found in that judgment. No different than in a criminal case. There's always got to be a mechanism where deception, false statements, people who make them are held accountable. By analogy, even if the police were to violate the constitutional rights of a criminal suspect by violating his Miranda warning, and a trial judge determined that because of that violation of the Constitution, the remedy was the exclusion of that evidence, the truth of what that defendant said. Under New York versus Harris, if that defendant were to get up on the stand, the exclusion of that evidence now would be trumped by the need for the court to get to the truth, and the prosecutor would be allowed.
However, there are limits, and of course the double jeopardy is the limit. You get to try it once, and that's if the jury decides against you and you know later that they're lying. I mean, that's the double jeopardy, constitutional double jeopardy. So, I mean, that doesn't, even if someone, there are cases that say even if they were not telling the truth, you get one shot at it to show it to the jury, and if they decide against you, I mean, you don't get to try them over and over.
And I'm not.
I mean, we all agree nobody should lie in court, but you don't get to say, well, the jury found him, believed him this time, so we'll try him again, and maybe they won't believe him the next time, and so forth. So there's a, how do we, you know, we've got to, we look at all of this and figure it out, and everything is dependent upon the facts of that case. Wouldn't you agree with that? So that's where we are here. How do we untwine, you know, is it so intertwined or isn't it intertwined? I guess that's what we have to figure out. And maybe you can help us on that. I mean, how do you, if it really was all before the jury, and it was so a part of whether or not he owed this to the, company, how do we know if you can intertwine this without getting too technical? Because also Ash says it can't be a hyper-technical kind of analysis. So maybe you can help us on that.
Justice Meyer Henry, you bring up a very interesting point, and it bears mention at this point that the state is not asking this court to go beyond what Ash versus Swenson says. But I think the analysis starts with what did the judge tell the jury? This case was actually presided over by Judge Johnson. And Judge Johnson told the jury a number of things. But one of the instructions that's very pertinent is what did he identify as the issues or the essential ingredients of the crime of grand theft? And those were those jury instructions that this involved the taking of property from Rocket Lube, that the intent of the defendant was to deprive Rocket Lube of their property, and that the value was over $1,000. And I think that if a reasonable explanation can be posited here in this court or to the trial judge, that there was another basis, that they did not necessarily reach this issue, that the acquittal in this case was grounded on something other than the belief that he performed the work on the transmission, then he can be prosecuted for perjury. And that was the argument that the defense made. He didn't say he didn't get the checks from Dr. Cox. He didn't say that he didn't do the work or that they were for artwork. He said that he got the checks from Dr. Cox for mechanic work. And he said he was entitled to that money because he had done it pursuant to moonlighting a side agreement with Dr. Cox. In other words, the essence in simple terms was he couldn't steal from himself because he was entitled to that money. The jury was not entitled that they could send us back some sort of a verdict finding him guilty of anything other than the theft from the identified victim, in this case, Rocket Lube Corporation.
Did you just argue that that was a necessary element tried in the first case then?
Did I argue? I never argued that the defendant had stolen anything of value from Dr. Cox. I never changed or drifted from what the ingredients of the crime were, which was stealing from Rocket Lube. And so if I misspoke, I apologize, but during the trial I never drifted and I never accused him of stealing from Dr. Cox. He put his credibility in issue by the statements he made, by the testimony he gave, by the fact that he produced these photos and showed them to the jury, and I tried to deal with his credibility as I would in any trial when that comes up. But I never drifted away from the elements of the crime that were set forth by Judge Johnson in his instructions. Never accused him of stealing anything from Dr. Cox. He was just trying...
All right. Well, let me restate it this way. If it was the defense that was brought up and argued, and the jury made a decision based on the defense rather than what you argued, would that still be an issue that was necessarily decided by the jury, even if the defense had brought it up? Was it a second question?
Whenever a jury reaches a verdict, it's difficult to say subjectively exactly why they reached the verdict that they did. And that's why the courts, I believe, always come up with an objective standard that was set forth in Ashe. Because if a person or a court were to try to subjectively analyze how did this jury reach this verdict based upon these facts, it would be next to impossible. So you have objective standards, like can the acquittal be grounded on something other than the issue that the other side is trying to seek foreclosure of? Did they necessarily have to reach this issue to find this defendant not guilty? And the state would submit not at all, that they didn't have an alternative. They weren't sent interrogatories to answer and questions coming back from the jury as to what to do. It was simply either he had stolen property from Rocket Lube or he was not guilty. And
2 minutes, counsel.
The ultimate issue determined in the grand theft jury was not the issue of perjury. The grand theft acquittal was not necessarily decided. It's not the same issue. There's nothing in this record that is inconsistent with an acquittal for grand theft and a prosecution for perjury. System depends on an oath being more than just a ritual. A violation of an oath needs a consequence, just as finality of an acquittal needs sanctity. Collateral estoppel principles apply, but they do not bar a defendant who commits perjury. It is not equated with a winner take all. That whatever you do to gain an acquittal on a theft charge before a jury is then somehow off limits, and that you can testify falsely with impunity. The grand theft trial was not a dry run. The state had no idea, number one, that the defendant would testify in his own behalf in the grand theft trial, let alone exactly what he was going to say. If the court were to hold that this estoppel, that the state is estopped from a prosecution for perjury, it would be a further expansion of Ash versus Swenson of any case, and not necessitated by the facts. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Fitzgerald. Court will be in recess until 10 o'clock.